Today on the Cameron Journal podcast, I am joined by Eric Monshine. He is someone I've met through my publisher, Something or Other Publishing, and we've already done great work together on the annual short story contest, and we have sent a dozen emails back and forth, including some campy legal advice I got about a new product I'm launching. So it's finally fun to meet him in person, well, over Zoom in person, live to tape. And we're going to talk about his book, of which we're celebrating its 10th anniversary, Life at 12 College Road. And Dr. Monshine is a lawyer and has taught law and education. And he is in New York, I believe, and just up the road from me. And so we're going to learn more about his book and his writing process and how this has all come together. So welcome, Eric, to the Cameron Journal podcast.
Thank you very much. And it's good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. So let's start from the very beginning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your book?
Okay. About myself. Well, okay. Educationally, I have a doctorate in law and education. I work for the federal government in a number of different capacities. I taught law and education at American University in Washington, D.C., and the State University of New York at Albany, University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and actually adjunct faculty with Evergreen State College way out on the West Coast. I then directed a law program for the New York State Bar Association for a number of years. And I then spent a number of years overseas and came back. And that's when I got into my writing that wasn't professional. I have written a number of law review articles and books on law and education. But this is where I decided that it would be more fun to just write something for myself. And that's what I did. And Life at 12 College Road came about by accident, really. I had gone to a writer's workshop in Maine, and I was dead set on writing this incredible action thriller. I had put together 5 chapters. I was really into it. And then I decided that I'd go lay down and take a nap. And whether it was dreaming or whether it was in that stage of just waking up, I remembered myself sitting at the dining room table where I grew up and had Sunday dinners. And there was my chair that I was sitting in. And then the 3 other chairs for my mom, dad, and my younger brother were all tilted in to the table so that their backs of the chairs, the ladder backs of the chairs, were resting against the table. And it dawned on me, because they have all passed on and I was alone. And I was sitting there realizing that I have a family, I have children, I have a wonderful life, but that at that moment I was alone. I was an orphan by definition. And that, you know, they'd gone on before me experiencing whatever they're experiencing. And hell, if I didn't realize my dog was gone too. And something about that, that when I, you know, really became aware that I was up and just thinking about the family, and it led me to drop what I was doing and just start writing about my growing up. And so that's what Life at 12 College Road is. It's a collection of 33 short stories about growing up in the 50s and 60s and what it was like in America then. And, you know, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
And it's something that, although it's my life, you know, what I realized was that, you know, no matter where we live, most of us really go through the same stages. There's happiness, there's sadness, there's anger, there's a feeling of loss, there's a feeling of wanting to be included. I mean, we all go through those things. And I felt, you know, if people read the book and it reminds them of memories that they've had, well, then I think that's accomplished something. So that's what
Yes. I was thinking so much about, the family moving on and feeling a bit lonely and all this type of thing. My mother's father, who I didn't meet till I was 15 because him and my grandmother had divorced, passed this year. And that was something that I didn't really think would really necessarily affect me, but we've all moved up a position. Like their parents, all this type of thing. And also, like, my parents are retiring. They're getting ready to sell their house because they're doing RVing full time. And, you know, and we're now having conversations, you know, like I have, you know, the important affairs in the event of their, you know, in their death. And we're talking about all of these things. And I'm about to inherit all this stuff because they're selling the house. So, you know, if I want, I've got to come here. And so this will be a U-Haul trailer coming next summer.
Been there, done that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, for my dad, it's been really tough because his mother, who is my dear, dear friend, Nana, is still with us, but she downsized from a house to an independent living facility. So that was move number one. Then his father passed 5 years ago. So that was another that of stuff that appeared and there's all this sort of thing. And then now that my, you know, so it's, you know, so between the two of them, there's only one parent left alive, his mother. And so we've kind of all unceremoniously moved up a position to now I'm, you know, my mom and I are having the conversations of, I don't really worry about you guys as long as there's two of you, but when one of you dies, the other one has to come live with me. Like, and mom, if that's you, that means you're going to have to love the East Coast because I'm not moving to West Texas. Yeah, so it's so I told her, I said, when you come next summer, we're gonna look around. I live in Wilmington. I'm like, we're gonna look around Wilmington and you're like learn to love Wilmington, like, you know. So it's so like in that way, my mother is an orphan because and she's the oldest of her siblings as well. So she's, you know, really the next she's it now, sort of thing. Yeah. And that is she would never admit out loud that she thinks about that, but I can see that she has had the thought sort of thing. She's now the oldest member of her family, which is just so weird, you know. And I definitely resonate with the being lonely because I am an only child. So when my parents all kind of, and my mom's told me, she's like, we kind of worry about you when we go because you're going to be really alone. And I'm kind of like, I know, I've known that for some time. It's okay. Our family is very small. And my grandma had four kids. Of those four kids, only two had children. So our family had a chance to get a lot bigger and shrunk. So I said, yeah, I know. I said, I already know that my, you know, when I hit my mid 50s, early 60s, it's going to get real, real lonely around here. It's going to be me. And I'm going to have to buy a dog. Like, it's, you know, sort of thing. So no, that's interesting. So now the title, enough about me, back to you. Yeah. 12 College Road, was the address you grew up in.
It literally was the street address. Fine. That I grew up on. And when my parents first moved there, I was very young, five. Yeah. And it was Almshouse Road. Because at the other end of the road, way down, about 6-7 miles, because we lived in the country, there was an almshouse, which really was a home for the elderly.
It's like
the old assisted living type of thing.
Right.
People who take care of themselves. And that was changed into a college. And it became Rockland Community College, which now became Rockland College. It's in New York State. It's outside of the city in Rockland County. But then, you know, so the house that the road name changed. And so I lived at 12 Road instead of 12 Almshouse Road.
Yes. Yes. My dad's grandmother grew up in college, in State College, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
So it's, yeah, so that was, yeah, we went up there one time and saw the house she grew up in, all this stuff. It was very fascinating. So, no, I love that address. When we lived in Arkansas, we lived on Pug Geyer Road, and Pug Geyer was still alive of Pug Geyer Road. And so he was, that was for 30 years ago. He was in his 90s. It was really cute to be kind of like Pug Geyer Road, and here is the person in question. So I always think that stuff's interesting.
Yeah, the sad part for me is that when you go to College Road and you see the number 12 College Road, it's now an office building. And the woods,
so sad.
And the so-called forever wild woods that were behind our place, because you couldn't see a neighbor. I grew up in the country, literally the country, where our dog, which was a collie, which of course was named Lassie. Never wore a collar. And I mean, this was, my parents had a few acres, and behind us was 26 acres of someone else's just forever wild. And on the other side of that was a humongous, like 1,000 acre apple orchard and farm. So it was just nothing behind us. And it was a wonderful place to grow up. But now, if you go, there's an office building at 12 College Road, and right behind it, where those wonderful woods were, is an indoor ice skating rink and tennis court sports-a-rama. And the rest of it's all parking lots. And the farm is gone, and now that's all houses. The trees are gone. I mean, it's just gone. And that was hard for me to deal with. So...
yeah, it's, I'm amazed. My grandma's house in Fayetteville, Arkansas, when I lived there and was growing up there in the 90s, early 2000s, we were in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was 45 minutes to town. Yeah. Fayetteville has grown a lot. Last time I was down there, Fayetteville is creeping out there. It's not quite in the middle of nowhere as it used to be. So which was fun. But, you know, it is kind of amazing and sad when things... my mom and I talk about this a lot because she's lived in a couple places. She's lived in Texas, lived and then moved back to Colorado in her 20s and all this type of thing. And so Denver has changed a lot. You know, even she moved back in 83. And Denver has changed so much since then. And she'll talk about all of that. And I didn't really understand it. But now I left Denver in 2014 and I go back every once in a while. And I laugh. I said, Mom, I said, so much has gotten torn down and changed. I'm using GPS. I grew up here and I'm on GPS because I don't know how to get anywhere. It's, you know, half the roads don't go through. There was like, that was a road. It's now a building. Like, you know, it's.
You said you're in Wilmington. Is that Delaware or South Carolina, North Carolina?
Delaware. I'm in Wilmington, Delaware. Yeah.
I actually went to college in Dover, Delaware. Wesley College is where I started to go to college, where I met my now wife.
I have a dear friend who also went to college there. Yeah. So she lives in Trinity. Yeah.
I know Dover. I know Delaware.
Yes, that's I always wanted to move to New York City. I cannot afford to live in New York City. So Delaware is as close as I can afford to live. And so I'm here. when I want to go to New York, I get on the train and I go to New York.
Well, you see, you actually live closer to New York than I do because I live in upstate New York. And when we say upstate New York, see, New York City, New Yorkers say upstate New York is like you're going upstate to Sing Sing, which is Westchester County, which is like 20 minutes from the city.
I know. Yeah.
Now, we live an hour north of Albany, and we actually are closer to Montreal than we are to New York City. So we're upstate. We always kind of laugh when people
up
say,
in the hump. I was up there in Elizabethtown, not this summer, but 2022. Okay. There's a great organization that does writing residencies called Cray Garden. And so I was up in the Adirondacks in the humpy bit near Canada. I got to go to, the Olympics, where was it?
Lake Placid.
Thank you. Placid. Yes, I was in Lake Placid, and
place. It's a wonderful place.
I loved it, and I was only there for a night, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I needed to be here for 3 days. I was so sad I had to go do this thing because I wanted to hang out. But it was really cool to see the 1932 arch and all the venues and all the Olympic stuff. It was fantastic. Yeah. So
And one of the things that's nice about the Adirondacks and up there in Saratoga and Saranac Lake, which is up there, is the Adirondack Center for Writing has been an incredible resource for me.
Yes, yes. I know that organization well. Yeah.
So it's been quite good. Up here in the middle of the mountains, in the middle of nowhere, we have a nice group of us who stick together and help each other with our writing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's great. That's one of the things I love about this region of the country is there's so much literature, literary culture that we just don't have in the West. We just don't. I love it, and it's so invigorating, you know, as a writer. My mother's family, my grandmother's family, comes from Binghamton in the Southern Tier and areas surrounding. And I have a great aunt on my dad's side who lives in Unadilla, which is on the way to Oneonta. So I was also there last summer and all that sort of thing. And there's always the great debate if they consider themselves upstate or not, because they're more just kind of over to the left from New York City. Not really up, it's more like over to the left.
Or just to the west. I know. It's kind of west. We don't think of that as upstate New York.
No, I mean, this is the debate that always goes on forever and ever, you know, is where, you know, where is it considered? So it's, but you know, it's, we have fun.
Well, let's just say where we live, the Hudson River runs for a time west to east, not north-south, which is New York City. It runs from the north-south. But when you go up high enough where we are, and literally it's about a mile and a half, it takes a bend and goes west and then heads up north a little bit longer where it actually, you know, is the origins of the Hudson. And up here, you can swim in the Hudson and you can fish in the Hudson, and it's clean water.
Yes. You will not want to jump off a pier in the Port Authority in Manhattan and do that.
No.
Do not recommend.
I'm amazed because I see people fishing and it's like, one, I don't think they catch anything that would actually bite their hook.
And why would you want to eat anything that came out of that?
I don't think you would. But
no.
But again, up here it's different. We love it. The mountains, and it's wonderful up here. So that's why we enjoy it.
Yeah, so. No, the Adirondacks were great. The only problem is you have in the summer those terrible bugs that when they bite you, they draw blood. Oh, my goodness.
They do. They are. Now, they're more prevalent if you get farther up into the mountains.
Yes.
But when you go outside in the spring, you have to be careful. They really love my wife. They just, I mean, they eat her alive.
I was in the same boat. I went through three cans of Off Deep Woods. I don't think it helped. I think I was just doing it as an exercise to make myself feel better because I was still getting bit. That was the only, but otherwise it was lovely. I got to stay in this lovely stone mansion. It was gorgeous.
And that only really is for a couple of weeks in the late spring, and then they go away. They do.
Yeah. No, it's quite lovely, lovely environment and very nice people. And I love I went there to get a couple bottles of wine for the people I was staying with and state owned liquor store. So I popped around to the little guy, and this is still, you know, kind of pandemic times. And so he has a sign on the front that says one person at a time. So I politely wait on the porch and the person comes out and I go in and I'm at the counter and the guy opens the door. He's like, "Are you really only doing one person at a time?" And he's kind of like, he's kind of like that's BS, and slams the door and leaves. And I'm kind of like, I'm literally checking out. If you wait 30 seconds, like, it will be fine. Just I love different towns and regions and people you'll meet along the way and weird, quirky local stuff. I like that stuff. Most people are annoyed by all that stuff. I find it adorable.
You know, just as my wife was during the pandemic, she was the curriculum coordinator for one of our local schools up here, well, the Lake George School District. The Lake George School District closed for the first couple of weeks during the pandemic, and then they were open for business the rest of the time. And so those kids were able to get a good education still. They're not behind. They stayed. They went to school. Everybody went to school, and nobody got, you know, got, the COVID. I mean, it was amazing. It's, again, different places. You live in the country. There aren't that many of us. There's almost a natural, you know, distancing, and the kids were smart and they stayed apart. And it's, you know, city life can be dangerous. And I think COVID demonstrated that too.
Well, and that has been true since time immemorial. I mean, the bubonic plague, the wealthy would leave to their country houses to get out of the city and away from the disease. That was one of the things, one of the problems they had in Unadilla is because it is only about 2 hours from New York City, everybody who had a second home or a friend with a second home in that part of the country all came out of the city and spent like a year and a half out there. And they brought COVID with them, of course. And of course. They ended up having, and it was really bad because they don't have a lot of health infrastructure in Otsego County. There's not much in Otsego County. And so it was really a terrible impact on local medical because they had all these extra people that they're not equipped to handle. And ended up with a lot of extra COVID infection they probably wouldn't have had if people hadn't come out of the city. And and so it was quite, there's, if you sit in the Unadilla diner, there's a lot of bitterness about that, as I was told during my recent visit.
Any small town, if you want to know what's going on, have a meal at the local diner, you'll be filled in.
I do, and I enjoy that very much so. And all the local stuff is always quite good. So yeah, that's been true for forever. And so yeah, it's a difficult thing. But so anyway, we've completely not done a good job about talking about your book. So let's return. Why don't you tell us some of the stories and things that are in the book? What was life like at 12 College Road?
What was life like at 12 College Road? Well,
give us some years and settings. About what year did you guys move there?
1954. Okay. We lived in two houses before that in the local area. One was the very first house they moved, because when I was born in the city, Flushing, New York, Long Island, right outside of the city. My dad was a practicing attorney with his law office in the city, but he didn't want me or my younger brother to grow up in the city. So we moved out to Rockland County, which meant he would take the train, the Erie Lackawanna train, from Suffern into New York, into Hoboken, and then take the ferry at the time to downtown. He traveled probably 4 hours a day just to go back and forth to allow us to live in the country, which was something that I found remarkable.
That is remarkable, yeah.
The first house he rented was part of, it had a hot house, like a nursery. And I can still remember all of the incredibly large spiders that always seemed to be in the house, which terrified me. And I had to have been just a 3 or 4 year old, but it still stands out.
Yeah.
We then moved to another home that we rented that was at the other end of the county by a stream. And it was a very nice house. And I remember coming in and telling my parents that the woods were on fire. And they said, oh, that's nice. And, you know, I was right. The woods were on fire. And so the fire engines had to come and put it out. And then that's when we moved, I guess it was 55, 56. To College Road, Almshouse Road, which became College Road soon thereafter. And that's where I grew up and spent my time. And then when I went to college, they were still living there. When my brother went to college, and he was 2 years younger, it had gotten to the point where it was incredibly difficult for my dad to do that commute. And so they sold the house and moved into the city. And so that was the end of us going back there. What I didn't realize is when they sold the house, everything that I had in my room sort of was thrown out, which was a shock. Not that I needed it. I was married at the time and I was living away. So that's when they left. But my period of time was literally from the mid-50s to like 1970. I would say.
No, that's, yeah. So why did you decide to go into law as well?
Well, I did and I didn't. And it may be because my dad was a lawyer. I decided that I didn't want to practice law. So I have a degree in law and education, but I never wanted to practice. So I didn't go ahead and take the bar exam. So I got to play with the law. I got to teach the law, but I didn't want to be a practicing attorney, which really annoyed my father, which is probably why I did it.
There was a similar story in my Nana's family. Her father was an attorney in Unadilla, New York, small kind of one-man law firm, safe full of wills type of thing. A farming community, this sort of thing. Tried to convince his son, my Nana's younger brother, to go into law, and he was not hearing of it. So that was into that. His, ironically, his father, my Nana's grandfather, had also went to Cornell, got a degree in law, passed the bar, said you could never make me practice law, and never did it.
Yeah. Now, what I did with it was, besides teaching the law, and it was usually education law and the constitutional rights of students, of teachers, but I also, the first real job I had, I worked for the U.S. Office for Civil Rights in Washington. And from there, honestly, I found that when I was there, I saw memos where the White House was telling the office not to enforce the civil rights legislation. And I found that to be reprehensible. And so I ended up moving to where I became the special assistant to the policy advisor to the U.S. Commissioner of Education. Now, that's before there was a U.S. Department of Education. This is when the E of education was part of HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare. But I ended up, I mean, it was a wonderful job.
We don't get Department of Education until 1978.
Just about maybe 76.
I think it was under Carter, so it had to be after 77.
It was before 1980. And
because Reagan ran in 80 on that he would get rid of the Department of Education.
That's right, which is one of the reasons I left. I had a job at the here's what happened. This is fun. I worked for the Office of Civil Rights. I then worked for the policy advisor to the U.S. Commissioner of Education. One of the jobs I was given was I was the contract officer for the We brought in, and I say we, the government brought in the former living commissioners of education, Democrat and Republican. And they proposed a U.S. Department of Education. And it was bipartisan, Democrats, Republicans. They thought it was important. For me, that was exciting. But I ended up voting for President Carter and lost my job because he became president. And I ended up working then at the Mass Department of Education for a Bureau of Student Services, enforcing student rights in Western Massachusetts, which was wonderful. I had a ball, although I couldn't really feed my family on what they were paying me. So I worked my way back into Washington to American University, and I was there. And then I got a job with the National Institute of Education, which was part of the Department of Education, which is already in existence. So that had to have been 1980. Yeah. And I was on a legal and governmental studies team that examined how law impacted on education. And living in Washington, we had two children who were very young. And my wife and I were like, Washington is a phenomenal place to live if you're single or married without children. But it's not the greatest place to raise a family because I couldn't afford to live in Washington. We lived way out in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and I used to have to commute taking the train.
Yes.
But no, they didn't have the metro yet.
I know Gaithersburg, Maryland. Well, I lived in Shepherdstown, West Virginia very briefly. And we used to go into Gaithersburg. There's a donut shop there. Yeah. So I know that part of the country very well. Yeah.
So it was nice, but I ended up seeing there was a job announcement for the director of a law, youth, and citizenship program that was being run by the New York State Bar and in cooperation with the New York State Education Department out of Albany. And so I applied, and I got it. And so we moved. And I was there for 15 years directing the program, which was wonderful. And that's how I was also teaching at SUNY, State University of New York at Albany. And yeah. it was a good experience. But, you know, from when I was at Wesley College in Dover, Delaware, my English literature professor really wanted me to write. Because, you know, there was a course and I wrote some poetry and he really admired the work and he really wanted me to focus on it. And that's when he said, you know, if you don't, because I said I really was interested in political science and law.
Yeah.
Said, you can do that, but then really you're using a different part of your brain. And I think in some ways he was right. And I ended up eventually going back to writing, but I owe it all to Professor Hughes, even. And I mentioned him in the book because he really gave me the ability to want to write. And that was something that I enjoy doing. I do. I enjoy writing.
I started out writing very young and then did 2 degrees in political science and then got back into writing through doing media stuff. And magazine stuff and all this type of thing. And then I was working at this fashion and culture magazine and nightlife. And I was, you know, spending my, you know, early 20s in, you know, bars, clubs and all this sort of thing. And that business collapsed due to some theft. And I was trying to process what had happened because we were really on the precipice of taking on another much larger project and really growing. And it had been 2.5 years of eating ramen or not eating at all. I mean, sometimes my meal was vodka. That was what we were eating today. And all this type of thing. And it just, I left my office on Friday and by Monday it was all over. And when I started trying to process what had gone on, I found this very mature writing voice that I didn't know existed because I hadn't written creatively in 5 years at that point.
Yeah.
Didn't know it was there until I started using it. And that was how I ended up getting back into creative writing. So,
well, yeah, I guess one of the things that helped me or motivated me was that I would always, usually, you know, when we get together as family, we'd be telling stories about, you know, what happened when I was growing up. And I know my wife really encouraged me. She said, you know, you ought to write this stuff down. It's fun. I mean, you know, it's really enjoyable. And so I started to. The only thing I didn't do, though, was there were a number of things that I never told the family about. So when my son finally read the book, he was really annoyed with me because I had never told him about these things. And I said, when you were young, there was no way I was going to tell you about some of these. The last thing I needed for you to do was get in trouble. But it turned out to be good because my son is an actor now. Mm. And his wife is an actor. And he also does voiceovers. And he's the one who did the audio of my book.
Oh, so very nice.
Very special. That was my son who did it. And he's professional. And he did a phenomenal job. I mean, it was when I listened to it, he had me enthralled, which I was... He's quite good. So I really appreciated the fact that we were able to do that and that he was part of this experience.
I mean, I have to say, it sounds like a very magical sort of thing to be, you know, in a house, in a wood, not surrounded by much, really free to roam and all this type of thing.
Well, yeah.
You know, in the zeitgeist of the 50s and 60s, I'm writing a book about my grandmother's life and it starts in 1954. So I've really had to really understand that period of the 20th century. And it's just it always seems, as a millennial who grew up in the 90s, it seems very magical.
When you look, there's a lot that went on in the 50s and 60s that, you know, was for other people, etc., not a pleasant time. That's a given.
Of course. But I mean, to be a child in that environment, it
but as a
was really
child
good.
growing up where I did, and thankfully with the parents I did, because and that's part of some of the short stories, we had people coming through our house from every country you can imagine, every color, every culture. This is, I mean, well, my parents gave me this. It was a gift that they were able to share with me. And so I got to see things that for me, I took for granted. And as I grew older and I realized that, you know, well, I never, you know, the prejudice and discrimination, it just wasn't part of my life. And for me, I was thankful for that. I mean, that was a blessing for me because we had everybody coming through the house, people from Uganda and Kenya and okay, Ireland and Italy, but also Mexico and Chile. And I mean, it was just, this is what they did. And I think that helped me. It was, for me, I mean, I came from a family at that time. My dad was Jewish. My mother was a Baha'i. And so as a Baha'i, it's just, it was a whole, the people who came through were people from all over the world. And this is just, this is what we did. And so I grew up in a house that was a Jew and a Baha'i. And what I loved about it was that my dad insisted that every child should celebrate Christmas. It was just something special. And, you know, not the religious part of it, but he wanted to celebrate. So when my brother and I went to bed on December 24th, when we got up on the 25th, there was a tree. There were trains running around the tree. There was footsteps from the fireplace to the coffee table. The cookies were gone. The milk was gone. I mean, it was growing up in the 50s, you know? Yeah. I mean, this was the, now the other thing that you did when you grew up in the 50s was you also, as a child, you got to wear a cap gun and you could play cowboys and Indians or good guys and bad guys. For me, I always played the Civil War. I was always the North. That's going to be the way it was. But these are the things that, you know, that you remember. Now, you know, one of the short stories I had that I write about, and I don't want to give them away, but it was a life moment where I explain all the different things we used to do. But this particular Christmas, my brother and I got up early and we went downstairs. And instead of getting mom and dad up, we opened all the presents. That did not go down well when my mom got up.
No, I'm sure it did not.
The entire joy of seeing your children opening the presents and Christmas was never the same after that. It was not the same.
I always enjoy the I love parents of small children. They're kind of like, oh my god, getting up at 5 a.m. I said, wait till they're teenagers. You will not open presents a second before noon.
Oh, like, no.
I helped raise my cousins in Christmas. I didn't even hit the door till 10:30, 11 a.m. Girl's not up before noon. Christmas at that age starts at about 1 p.m. I'm like, you are losing sleep till they're about 12 or 13. You're gonna make it all up when they're in high school, trust me.
Exactly. But there were certain things that, you know, the stories deal with happy times, sad times, trouble. I was trouble. I admit that. I was a tough one to be raising. I mean, it was just in me. But at the same time, my parents thanked God for my mother because she understood. And, you know, how do I explain it? There's one where I got in trouble and I got punished to my room where I wasn't allowed out. Well, the sad part was just before I got in trouble, I saw the movie The Great Escape with Steve McQueen.
Oh, no.
And I couldn't help it. Oh, hold on. Believe it or not, it's Wade. So I'm going to just tell him. Hello, Wade. I'm in the middle of a race. The publisher. But anyway, yes.
That's...
What was I saying?
Well, you were about to make your great escape from your room, okay. Steve McQueen escape. Style. Yes.
Yeah. And so I realized that the window in my room, one of the windows in my room overlooked the driveway. And it had one of those gigantic storm windows that you pushed out. And if I put the wire there, I could go out, I could get back in. And that meant I was free. And it must have been 10 o'clock at night, and I got out. And I'm outside, and the next thing I know, there's lightning, there's rain, there's thunder. Everything is going crazy. So I figure I better get back in the house. And as I go to get back in the house, lightning goes off, and standing in the window is my mother. And I'm outside. And so I go all the way around, and she lets me in. And she's really annoyed because now I not only got in trouble for what I was in trouble for, but now I wasn't even obeying them when I was getting out of the house. And I tried to explain that really it was the matter of I had seen The Great Escape and I was caught up in it. And I figured, why not give it a try? And she looked at me and I'll never forget. She said, "And how did that end?" And the way it ended was simple. Those people, the soldiers who got away, who got caught, were all executed. So there you go. So
yeah. Yeah.
And added another month to my sentence. So anyway, but these were some of the stories, and some of them are happy ones. Some of them I think people will get a kick out of. And I think many of them, at least when I've talked to people who've read the book, it's reminded them of things in their lives that they had forgotten, which in remembering them brought back emotions that they were glad they were feeling. And that makes me pleased. So, you know, in that regard, even though it's my memoir, we all have basically the same things we grow up with. We really do. And even I found different cultures. We go through happiness, we go through sadness, we go through loss, we go through good times, we go through bad times, you know, and we grow up. Now, there's a lot of the 50s and 60s that I think, I'm sorry, we don't have it. I mean, when I grew up, you went out, you went to school, you got home, and you just better show up at dinner, when dinner's served. But the idea of play dates, what the hell is a play date?
That started, there was the beginnings of that when I was a kid. And that was for like, really, I knew a girl in elementary school named Pauline. Her mother was Jewish and a psychiatrist. And that was like the weird Jewish psychiatrist thing. Yeah. Like it was just like, it was much, much more fluid. I told people, I think, you know, you have to be a millennial, and particularly one born before 1990, to have had like the last hurrah. Like my mom would just like be kind of like, okay, there's a park at the top of our road. And it's like, okay, I'm like, I'm going to the park. And my mother would just let me go. Cell phones not yet invented, folks. Oh, I was just out there sort of thing. Like, you know, I used to go, because I grew up in Denver. I would shovel people's driveways for money. And I would just go around with my snow shovel on my shoulder, digging out people's cars, getting money, all this type of thing, blah, blah, blah. And that was just how it went. Now, today's kids would never. Like, that's no longer a thing. And I think we were the last hurrah of kids who were allowed to like go out into the world by them, you know, by themselves.
And believe it, I mean, I understand it because, you know, our kids went out. I mean, my kids were born in 76 and 79. And, you know, that was a different age. But literally, we didn't have the issues that you have today. I mean, we went out. Everybody looked out for each other. And even if even your neighbors, if you did something wrong, they'd give you a good smack, and it was expected. I mean, it was expected, and you didn't. The last thing you wanted in that time was, you know, oh my God, I'll do anything, just don't tell my dad or don't tell my mom. And even in school, some of the stories that I write about that went on in school. I mean, today you'd probably go to jail.
Yeah,
you did what I did.
Yeah, no, there's so many, you know. That's one of the tragedies after Columbine with putting cops in schools, is all it did was create a generation of people with a juvenile record.
Exactly.
It has not incidentally stopped school shootings. No, so
that's a whole nother discussion, but no, it has nothing to do with school shootings. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. We could do a whole show just on that. Yes. And so that is a terrible thing. No, it is difficult, but I think it also, I think to some degree it's hard because the world is more complicated now more dangerous now
and all this type of thing.
And I think to have small children now is quite, I have friends with kids, and I think one of the tough things, one of the reasons people aren't having kids anymore, and if they are, they're having fewer of them, is because you have to be so involved now. There's so much to do. There's so much involvement, so many activities. It's like you're a manager for a rock band. It's way too much.
I watch my daughter. They have three children.
Yeah.
They have a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
And it is nonstop going because they all do different things. They're all in different schools. They all have extracurricular activities.
Yep.
And when they were growing up, yeah, where they live, I wouldn't let my granddaughter out by herself. Now, we had different issues. We live up here in the mountains, and when our grandchildren were really little, we never let the little ones out by themselves because there were certain things that could come and get them, and it's not people, it's animals.
Yes.
So they didn't go out there by themselves. But
no, the local mountain lion's like, oh, lunch delivered.
I literally fisher cats and coyotes and you know, when you're an adult, there's no problem, but you have to be careful. But it's a different kind of concern. When I grew up, my parents we went out, you know, and we came back when it was, you know, you'd be back at sunset and you just better be back. And we were. That was the other thing. And
yeah,
idea of talking back to your parents, I mean, that got you, that was, you know, you, that was a death sentence. You didn't want to do that.
No, there's lots of times where, like, especially as a person of, no, like, especially like when you're like a person of color growing up, all this type of thing. And you look at it as kind of like I did not grow up with a parent of color, but I know people who did. And it's kind of like, there's no, like, my mom is Southern from West Texas. The primary response to being asked to do something in my household was the phrase, yes, ma'am. That's what you want to lead with. And so these kids today that come along and say a bunch of other stuff, it's kind of like, oh, how are you alive? My mom would have killed you 2 minutes into this interaction. Like, that would have been, she would have been at the mugshot with a smile on her face. Like, that's, you know, it's, I'm, kids today do a lot. And I'm just like, no, that is not okay.
I grew up in a household, my dad never touched us. I mean, physically, like punishment, you know, and hugging was slight and rare, but he never punished us. And that's because he had been abused as a kid, and he was terrified that he would do it. So he never touched us, which was a good thing. Mom was a Navy nurse from World War II with a brown belt in judo, and she was a disciplinarian, and she had no problem kicking the crap out of you. I mean, so if you gave her lip, you were down for the count.
Yeah. It's, you know, my mom is a battleship and very intimidating. And like I said, it was, you know, I mean, I grew up in a world where, you know, you didn't, nowadays kids address adults by their first name.
I don't know. And it's also
there are people to, I am 35 years old and I have people I know from college that I still refer to them by Miss, Mrs., Mr. and last name. In fact, I was just joking with this with my mom. I said there are people I still refer to them that way because they are decades older than me and that's just respectful. And she's kind of like, well, she's like, why is that? I'm like, because you raised me that, like, that's how you raised me, mom. This is your fault.
and honestly, that's the way I was raised. I mean, that's what you did. And it was all my friends' parents were, you know, Mr. Smith, Mr. Ryan, Mrs. Ryan. And today you listen to them, you know, call me Emily. I could never call them by their first name.
No,
and if I did, my mother would have dealt with me.
No, I had a dear friend of mine who was an admin in an office that I hung out in college. And I always refer to her as Miss Kelly. Her name's Diana. I know her name. I am 35 years old. I would never walk up to her and say, hello, Diana. Hello, Miss Kelly. I'm 35 years old. I pay my own bills and taxes. I would never call her by her first name. I'm not of that generation seniority. Good morning, Miss Kelly. Like, that's it. It's very different environment now.
It was how I was raised as well. And one of the things is that because of my jobs that I've had, I dealt with a lot of judges. Yeah. And it didn't matter how close I was. It was always Judge Price, Judge Monahan, whatever it was. And they would call me, no, don't be silly, Rick. Call me Rich. And I went, you're a judge. I can't call you that. My father wouldn't accept it. And he's not here anymore. But I still can't call you Rich.
Yeah, and I mean, I do have to say, knowing how to do that was helpful. I worked in the Colorado State Senate when I was 17. At the time, there had only been 5 kids in high school who'd ever worked in the state Senate. And that's an environment where you have to be very, very mindful of titles and positions and hierarchies and all this type of thing. And so it was awkward for a lot of other people, but it was something I was able to navigate really easily because I was already kind of used to that. You know, and I would be the same way. You know, it's just one of those things of the only people I refer to by first name are those who are near peers and younger. So you can't be more than 5-7 years older than me, and like, or that's as far as it goes. And then it's at my age and then younger, yes, but like, you know, it's like if you're significantly older, then no, it's just not. You have to be a near peer, because that's, you know, and for me, it's a respect thing. It's an honorific. It really is an honorific.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, it's the way I was raised. And I know that even my grandkids refer to people on, you know, except for, I mean, I'm Pop and my wife is Gigi. So Pop and Gigi. Okay, fine. But when you see them with their teachers or meeting some other adult, they always refer to them as Mr. or Doctor or Ms. I mean, that's just the way they were taught. Because their father wouldn't tolerate it.
Yeah.
So this is what you do. It's a sign of respect.
Yeah, no, I just contacted a professor friend of mine the other day because she's doing diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff. Uh-huh. And it's kind of like, there's no way I would address her as Anita. That is her name. But there's no way I would address her as Anita. Dr. Fleming Reif.
That's what I do with my professors. They were my professors. So I always refer to them as Dr. Fisher or professor. I would never call Lou. I just wouldn't.
Yeah. No, it is one of those things, how times have changed, because the younger generation is much more comfortable and that sort of thing. And the one place where I know that stuff still doesn't fly is the South. That's still not okay. Cause we're old fashioned. That's still not okay. There was a great YouTube video of this kid in Texas going around addressing teachers by their first name. And it was, the reactions were hilarious, because that was not to be done.
No, it was not to be done.
Well, we're coming up on the hour and I have another recording. I got to go. But well, so why don't you... I know that you probably don't have any online presence, but I do want to let the listener...
I do.
Oh, you do.
If people are interested... it's www.ericmonshine.com.
And wonderful.
I'm on LinkedIn, and that's at Eric Monshine. But the website will get you to some of the stories that I've written, some poetry.
That's great.
Even a couple of the short stories I posted on the website to give people a taste that they might then want to see the book. But it's
and the book is available on Amazon, obviously.
And here is the book. I don't know if you can see it.
With your NABE sticker. Yep.
I was pleased to see that I won the Pinnacle Book Achievement Award for memoirs for this year, which was very nice. And the other one I'll plug.
I also won that award in literary fiction.
Yes,
so
congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much.
Also, 25 servings of soup. is a collection of short stories, and mine, Dinner at Grandma's, is included. So this is another book that was a short story that was not in Life at 12 College Road. So it was in this book, which I also would plug. There are some great stories in here. People would enjoy them.
Yeah, both of our editions of 25 Servings of Soup are great, and you can get those directly on Amazon, or you can get them directly at soupllc.com. So
I also found fantastic. That you can actually buy this book on the Walmart website. Go figure.
Yes, all of our books are distributed all over Walmart, Waterstones, Target,
Noble, everything.
Yes. Yeah. So if you enjoy fine books and all this type of thing, look for them all online. So, well, thank you so much for coming on the Grammar Journal podcast.
I thank you. And the hour went by so quickly. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode of the Cameron Journal podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Visit us online at CameronJournal.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I love to talk to my followers and listeners, so please feel free to get us on social media at Cameron Cowan on Twitter. And we'll see you next time on the Cameron Journal podcast.